Hello everyone and welcome to Celebrating Cinema. If you haven't already, please make sure to subscribe, leave us a review and share with friends. To coincide with the release of The Beast by Bertrand Bonello, now screening at Lab 111, I had the pleasure to speak with Bertrand, someone who I've long admired. But who is Bertrand Bonello? For me, he's one of the few working directors that understands the ways cinema relates to the crazy kaleidoscope of shit that we call the 21st century. A filmmaker who dares to experiment and liberate his movies of classic arthouse cliches while still making cinema with a capital C. His 2011 film House of Tolerance was an eye-opener for me in the way he treated the historical drama set in a Parisian brothel at the beginning of the 20th century with the most postmodern means ever, like split screens and ruptures in the linear timeline. That invigorating mastery of film language found also an incendiary subject matter in his Nocturama, probably the best film about youth, acts of dissent, terrorism and anti-capitalism that I've ever seen. With The Beast, Bonello's upping the ante even more. Set in the dystopian near future of 2044, the film features Léa Seydoux in a world dominated by AI that tries to purge human emotion wholesale. That act of erasing emotion involves a machine that takes you back in some kind of past lives, which suddenly warps Léa Seydoux also into 1910 and 2014. And in all of these timelines, Seydoux's character is haunted by something indescribable yet somehow real, a sense of danger and dread that is totally overwhelming, resulting in electrifying scenes that in turn also haunt us, the audience. It's safe to say that this sci-fi slash melodrama slash horror slash character study slash ghost story is one of my favorite films of the year, so I'm very happy to dive into this extensive conversation with filmmaker Bertrand Bonello. Let's get into it.
First off, thank you, Bertrand, for making some time to be on our podcast, Celebrating Cinema, to discuss The Beast, amongst other things. In our podcast, we actually always ask a first question to all of our guests, and that's if they can share a little bit of some of their, let's say, earliest formative cinema memories that they carry with them from childhood onwards. Do you have one that you could share with us?
Well, I have thousands. It's difficult to choose. I would go a little older than child, like 12, 13.
Sure.
I was living in the countryside, and it was the arrival of video clubs and VHS and stuff like that. So with a friend, we are going like every weekend to the newspaper shop because there was no video club in there. In the countryside, and he received like every week like some tapes, you know, of films, and there was only like horror films or porn films. So every Saturday we rent like four or five films and watch them like during the night, and I didn't realize at that moment we were watching very good films. For me, it was just like, you know, Saturday night films and just films for fun. But it was all the films of John Carpenter, David Cronenberg, Romero, Dario Argento, Lucio Fulci, and all these guys, and The Exorcist and stuff like that. So I know these films very well because we were watching them like, you know, 10 times. I don't know, when I was 25, 26, I watched them again and I realized there was not films just for fun, you know, that were great filmmakers behind the camera, great stories, and something very first degree in the genre films that disappeared a little after that. It was a way, in fact, for these directors to talk about the fear of the world, you know, by making films of fear. And I think that's a very strong history moment of my relationship with films.
And one more question about that, speaking about fear, because I was about the same age as you, maybe when I started watching horror films. I had a friend group that also tried to scare each other with, you know, picking the next scariest film that we could think of. And the scariest one that we could always think of was The Exorcist. For us, that was kind of like the summum of what we could consider to be a very scary movie. And then we always had to kind of like hide our fear and kind of like show our bravado a bit to each other. But when you were watching these films with your friends, did they actually scare you as well? Can you talk a little bit about the thrill of watching them?
We were having fun, you know, because I think we were too young to really understand the films, the deep meanings of the films. Some of them, yeah, really scared us, like The Shining. But even a film like The Exorcist, it's a very, very mature film. It's not just a horror film. The fact that, you know, the horror comes quite late in the film. There is a whole story beginning in Iraq. And then you have all the story of the priest and his mom, and, you know, and all these things make the film very scary because it makes the film in a way real, you know. It's not just like, okay, the devil is in little girl. It's a bit more than that. But I think we were too young to be really scary. The film scares me more now than it used to.
Yeah, I have the same thing actually with The Exorcist and with other films. And I think Fear is a good segue to The Beast, to be honest, which is a film, you know, that takes a lot of inspiration from Henry James, The Beast in the Jungle, which is also a text, a book on this sense of dread, this creeping fear that takes hold of this person's life. And you transpose that story to three different timelines, all starring Léa Seydoux as well. I've seen the film twice now, and I find it a quite scary film, but for reasons that are quite hard to put into word. But I think because you very succinctly captured that sense of dread, that kind of this fleeting feeling, but that also growing feeling that everything will go awry one way or the other. And I wanted to ask you a little bit about your relationship with the Henry James book, with the text, and how you captured the essence that is also especially in between the lines in that text and translated into film.
Well, it's a book I've read like a few times, like first time, I don't know, maybe 15 years ago, 20 years ago. And then I read it like three or four times, short book. But I really never thought of making an adaptation. But when I started to write on The Beast, to think about the ideas and what I was looking for, I just put some words on a piece of paper and throw, it's not like story or characters, but kind of words of desires, you know. And one of these words was melodrama. And that drove me back to the book because I could not myself imagine like a better, not story, but argument about the melodrama, about two people missing each other. So that's why I decided to take The Beast in the Jungle as a starting point. And in a way, I was very, very faithful to the book.
Yeah, totally.
Most of it is in the very long scene at the beginning in 1910, yeah. Like the party scene, the ballroom. And all the dialogues are from Henry James, and I'm very faithful. And then I became very unfaithful, you know, by exploding everything through three periods, swatching like the characters and stuff like that. But keep in mind that the two main feelings Henry James is talking about is fear and love. Yeah. That are two feelings that really go well together, you know. So I just tried to push these two words as far as I could.
It almost sounds like a melodrama itself, first being very faithful and then being unfaithful to the text.
Yes, that's true, yeah.
So what I really like about the James book and what I, you know, in the time that it was written, I think it very succinctly kind of captured this dread or this essence of what it must be like to live through the Fundis in Yekla and kind of like see the world change so rapidly in the 20th century. And I think that your film or your film work in general in the last 10 years or so has also very succinctly captured this shift from the 20th to the 21st century. Can you speak a little bit about how you maybe see a relationship between the passages in 1914 in The Beast and the ones that happen in 2014 and that will also happen in the story in 2044?
It's a long path, you know, it's a longer way of thinking. But, you have this part in 1910 where she's obviously the one that has fear of love. And 1910 is not the year of the book, but it's, you know, quite close. Then I wanted to find something more contemporary and switch for the it would be like the boy now who would be fear of love, who have fear of love. And I was thinking about these incels, you know, mm-hmm. Just say, wow, I hate women because they don't want me. But maybe there is something they cannot realize. It's their own fear of love. And that's why they do not abandon themselves to love. And I remember then these videos I saw 10 years ago of Elliot Rodger. Yeah. And I watched them back and I said, okay, of course, it will not be the same character, but it's great to start 2014 with these videos and these words, because maybe he says, like, literally, no girls want me, so I hate you, so I'm going to kill you. But I can feel there could be something more, you know, more deep than that. And it had to be like close from us, because it's something that goes with our modern times and relationship between technology and humanity, you know?
Yeah.
And I pushed this further in 2044, the relationship of humanity and technology and the fear of that, you know? And, but I have to say, the present of the film is 2044. It's, in a way, a science fiction film. And I realized that science fiction is great because it allows you, by creating a world in the future, to talk about your fear of the present, you know, and it's exactly what I've done. And I realized that the book of Henry James, for me, is even more relevant today than it used to be.
It's funny that you mentioned this about sci-fi, because it harkens back to what you were mentioning, the films that you watched when you were young that spoke to all of these fears and anxieties as well, which obviously science fiction is a very very poignant genre for. I do have a question about the 2014 era and about, you know, this incel culture that you show, this kind of like sexual politics of fear of love, and how you transpose that, because it's also a very hard to capture internet kind of radicalized online phenomenon a little bit as well, where people are very much entrenched in their own individual bubbles on the internet, and it expands and kind of like at the same time narrows their mind view and their look on the world. I think a lot of filmmakers are quite, you could say, hesitant to try to approach these themes or these happenings from the internet and transpose them to the cinema, because they see a distinction between the cinema as this, let's say, more formal 20th century art form and the internet as this hard to grasp thing that they don't have a grip on. Yet you're pretty, I would say, brave, but also very capable of finding these connections between film and the internet. Can you talk a little bit about how you see those medium relationships in the way that you deal with them in your films, but also in Coma or in Nocturama, for instance?
Mm. Well, in fact, we are living in a world of image. You know, images are everywhere. It's like everywhere on your computer, on the street, and everywhere. So at what moment you ask yourself, what is an image of cinema? And for me, it's not, it has to be not just one more image. It has to be something special. It doesn't mean you have on one side like the beautiful images that go on screen and like the trash images that, you know, are there. No, it's just they're mixing in our lives. But if you use like internet in a film, you have to make these images special in a way. So I try to include them in like in a entire world, our entire world, just to treat them with the thinking and not like something that comes into you, you know, blow into your mind. But there's no distinction, like, you know, like the nice 35 millimeters and the trash YouTube images. You know, it depends how you put them in your mise-en-scène and your storytelling.
You mess around very consciously with that in The Beast, and you also did that quite a lot in Coma, a film that uses footage that you shot yourself, but also includes a lot of these, let's say, more archival found footage from the internet. I'm wondering kind of like a little bit, so the philosophy is clear, but then still it's fun to see you play around with it, and you play around very consciously with the image. It reminded me a lot of, you know, watching House of Tolerance for the first time, which is a period piece. And then suddenly, unexpectedly, you have all these fantastic split screen compositions that almost give it this kind of like totally radical, different approach to the story. So this impulse to play around with the image has been around in your cinema for quite a while. When did you kind of figure out that you can break, let's say, the linearity of the mise-en-scene and have like total control and do whatever you want with it?
Well, if you take the example of House of Tolerance, yes, it's a period film. It takes place in 1900, but anyway, it's a film of 2011, you know, and it will be.
For sure.
That's why I've no problem with using like soul music and stuff like that, because it's a film of 2011, you know. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to use like a 1900 camera, you know, so it's the same. Yeah. But for example, for the split screens, every idea or answer starts with a question or a problem. For example, I was trying to find a way, a visual way, to say that the brothels were like prisons, you know. Mm-hmm. And split screens reminds you of prison because, you know, you're looked at, you know, like
your camera. Panopticon, yeah.
Exactly. So, you know, you search for a visual idea to say something, and you find it sometimes in modern images, you know.
Mm-hmm. So what would you say was the problem or the question of the beast for you?
Wow, there was a lot, you know. Each scene is a problem, you know, or a question, you know, or a question. Mm-hmm. But for each scene, you ask yourself, what's the heart of the scene? And what do I want to say? And what I want to say, it's not always in the dialogues, you know. There is something more to find, you know. And that's why it takes me a long time to prepare the films at my desk. Because I go on the set like with a huge notebook, you know, very, very precise. It's, for example, the beast is, I don't know, 2 hours and 25 minutes. And there are only 5 shots we did that are not in the film, you know. It's very, very prepared.
And then, is it then, to come back to that problem, because does it become like a conceptual journey through the editing as well? Because for instance, with respect to all of these timelines, and especially also with the way that you treat the material that you sometimes, okay, so in the film you have Leia Sidhu going into these, in the machine, back into previous lives, right? And you see this kind of like glitching sometimes of the machine, like the film itself almost breaking on herself, like the construct is at fault. Are those things that are always there, or are those things that you...
The film you saw is really the film that is in the script. Everything, the structure, the split screens, the when the images go back and stuff like that. It's all written. It's all written. Mm-hmm. In the editing room, we search for something else. The perfect rhythm, the perfect music. But there's no structural ideas that come from the editing room. It's all before the shoot.
You don't come from a very conventional film background, so I'm wondering, did you always have this kind of like pre-visualized outset on how you approached your films, or did you grow into that role when you became a more experienced director?
Well, I guess this became stronger with the experience, you know, but it's also because I'm quite scared, you know, and I want to prepare myself because I'm really scared to go on the set and not to have ideas. And, you know, it's I try. And also I try when I write, not to write a script, but to write a film, you know, mm-hmm. And there is not for me like the writing, the prep, shooting, editing, music, you know, it's, I try to figure out everything at the same time, you know. Doesn't mean that I do not change my mind on the set, but, you know, so even for the music, you know, if I start to write and I feel the scene would need some music, I stop the writing and I go to my studio and start to record some stuff. Then I go back to my desk and finish the scene, you know. And on the screenplay, you can see that's beginning of the music, end of the music. It's very, very precise, you know, and the music is already done. And I have my computer to write this screenplay. Then I have a notebook to write how it should be shot and stuff like that. I try to, that everything work together and not one after.
I have like a compilation of your soundtracks here on vinyl as well that got released by through Grasshopper Films, I believe. And what really strikes me is these kind of like sparse, actually electronic compositions that you use when you compose the music of your films yourself. Sometimes it veers into, let's say, a bit more maximalist mode, but often, for instance, especially with Zombie Child, there's almost this skeletal quality to it, which I really enjoy and I find very fascinating. And I know that you were a musician and came more from, let's say, a punky background. So I was wondering how you kind of segued into, let's say, the more electronic compositions that you now employ so much in your film scores.
Well, before like the punk and stuff, I had a lot of classical music studies.
Yeah.
But I went to electronic because you can create sounds, you know. At one point, a guitar is a guitar, even if you have so many effects and stuff like that. But there is something in the imaginary of sound which is endless with electronic. But now what I try to do for the last 3 or 4 years is to mix electronic with some like horns or prepared piano or guitars and to mix the both of them.
That's interesting. And I'm wondering also how coming from this musical background and then shifting into filmmaking, did that give you a somewhat maybe skewed or non-conventional approach or philosophy of how one should make a film, if you would compare that to other more formally trained filmmakers?
I think that what made me like do unconventional things is just because I didn't know how to make films. It's more that, you know? I haven't never done any film school or never been assistant. The first set I've been on was my set. And I didn't know nothing. So of course you know you're a little different because most of the directors when they go on the set for the first time they have a kind of background.
You said that you were kind of afraid of like making mistakes on set, so that's also why you prepare very heavily. When on your first set, did you make a lot of mistakes? What was this experience like?
I am afraid now. I was not at that time because you know when you do not know nothing, you're not afraid. You know, I'm more scared now than I used to be.
That's very funny.
Yeah. It's experience has good sides and bad sides.
It's the weight of life of growing older or something.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Speaking of which, you know, there's this interesting shift also I feel in your filmmaking that you start to make films that are more and more concerned with the youth, you know, with the younger generation and their position in the world. If you compare that to one of your earlier films, The Pornographer, about an Asian filmmaker and his outlook on life and his way of seeing through the camera. And then you look at Nocturama and that the way that they, the youngsters, look and rebel and protest and, you know, riot against the world. I see this kind of shift there. But I wonder if you could put a little bit into word what maybe happened also from your perspective when perceiving, you know, the world through the eyes of a young generation, for instance, in Coma or Nocturama.
Well, The Pornographer is a little different because when I started to write, I had a strong identification with the son of Jean-Pierre Léaud, you know. And it's like someone was entering life and say asking questions to himself about the fathers, you know, political fathers, cinematographer fathers, and intimate fathers. Now, 15 years later, I do Nocturama, and I could say, like, the kids in Nocturama could be, like, the small brothers of the kids in The Pornographer, you know? But 15 years has passed, and the world has changed a lot, you know? And the way of imagining, like, a revolution has changed a lot also. There's much more violence and much more concrete in that. So I wasn't planning to do, like, 3 films in a row about youth, but it's true that I'm really fascinated by youth because, of course, they the future, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot about them, you know, what we're going to leave them and how they're going to be able to think politically the world, you know. My films about the youth are not like first love story and stuff like that. There's always like a political inscription in the world of these young people, you know. And I don't think I would make another one, but I was really happy to make these three films in a row, like Nocturama, Zombie Child, and Coma. And also I have a daughter, which the age of the character of in Zombie Child and Coma. And it's all questions that came to my mind by looking at her, you know.
Mm-hmm. It's, you know, like when I saw Nocturama for the first time, and it also kind of like overlapped with me going to Cannes Film Festival for the first time and seeing kind of like all this security everywhere and this anxiety about, you know, terror scares and all of these things. It's very hard, especially also when you're young, to put into word what is wrong in the world, but you can feel it, right? And for me, it was kind of like a breath of fresh air to see a film like Nocturama, where you don't necessarily have the words, but you have the images and the actions and the gestures that help you understand. For me, it was in that sense, really a very formative film to make sense of the world that I actually live in.
Well, when the film was released in France, well, it was a special period because it was just after the attacks in Paris. People were not ready for this film, and it's like a terrible timing. But one thing that was reproached to the film is that there are no reasons. You know, we don't see the reasons. And I was always answering, well, I don't see why you need reasons. You know, if you read the paper, if you go in the street and take the metro, do you need reasons? You know, everything is in front of you. You know, I prefer to do a political film with gestures than with words, you know. And at that time was a little difficult for people. They wanted to understand why, which I did not. You know, I prefer behavior, you know, than words at that moment. And I was talking earlier about these political genres films that I saw when I was a teenager. And Assault by John Carpenter or Dawn of the Dead by Romero, there are political films, you know, but it's not, you know, it's not with words, it's behavior, you know.
Yeah, Assault on Precinct 13, you see kind of like a strong influence, I think, of that film in Nocturama.
Yeah.
And I was wondering, because also like your list of the best films in the Sight and Sound top 10, you know, list of recent years, recently did the rounds on Twitter again. I came across it and like I see the influences in those names. You know, you have your Lynches, you have your Jean Eustaches, you have kind of like a whole kind of like mix of directors that somehow make sense together if you put them inside a Bertrand Bonello film. But at the same time, every time I look at one of your films, it is also distinctly a Bertrand Bonello film. And I'm wondering kind of like how you deal with, you know, speaking of the pornographer and of, you know, the dads and the fathers and this previous generation that weigh on you, how did you kind of like come to terms with your own cinematic language while still acknowledging the things that gave you inspiration?
Well, I think it's for my generation and the one after. There's no distinction, you know. It's not like Robert Bresson is like huge movie maker and Dario Argento is just is not. And there's no problem with mixing everything, you know. It's and I don't call that influences. I call that circulation. It's not how things come into you and then they go back, you know, and it's the best way to keep on. I mean, you cannot do like if there was no history of cinema before you, you know, but let's make it natural, you know. It's not copying, it's just, you know, digesting and doing something else. That's why I think my films stay personal, even if I don't even see the influences, you know. I don't see them. It's just like a circulation.
Because I wanted to ask you one more question about that, because I kind of made a comparison between The Beast and Inland Empire by David Lynch, because I think both are films that very succinctly try to make sense of the 21st century in some weird, complex, intertextual, interlayered kind of way. Both of them star a leading actress that, let's say, takes the center stage and carries the entire weight of all of these narrative storylines. And there's also this relationship between the film and the story, but also having the actors as part of the story itself. It's a film about Laura Dern. This is a film about Léa Seydoux. Is that a film that is on your mind where you're making this, or are those subconscious connections and that I am now placing them on you
No, but I did a Q&A, like one of the first Q&As, one guy in the audience said exactly what you said. I didn't realize, but yeah, the fact that both films for like 2 hours and 30 minutes or something, take a female character and try to go inside her head and, you know, with fear and stuff like that, and, you know, losing control and losing, you know, what's really happening, you know, the sense of what's happening. And I didn't think about it, but it is very true, yeah.
And then one more thing about it, because it's very easy to describe a film as Lynchian, which has also been a bit of a, let's say, a cliche or a bit of a tired descriptor for a film. But how do you kind of relate to that description with this film? Because I think of all the films that you made, this one comes maybe closest to that weird feeling that's so indescribable, but yet totally Lynchian.
If there is something I took from David Lynch, is the fact that you have to allow yourself to be free and to feel your sensations, visual or sound and stuff like that. And him or Jean-Luc Godard, they were very important about freedom, you know. Otherwise, I know people talked a lot about David Lynch on this film, but mainly because of the Los Angeles part, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And for this part, the only film I rewatched two films, in fact, before shooting. One was The Age of Innocence for the 1910 part. And for the LA part, I was more inspired by a film called When a Stranger Calls by Fred Walton, end of the 70s, which is the story of a babysitter alone in the house with two kids, the first floor, and the telephone is ringing, and there is only one voice saying, have you checked the children? You know.
Oh my God, I haven't seen that film. That sounds fantastic.
Watch out, there is a remake, and the remake is very bad. It's the...
The 70s one.
Yeah, Fred Walton.
Fantastic. I wanted to ask some things about Léa Seydoux as well, because this is the third film that you made with her. And I was wondering, was it only possible basically to make The Beast by virtue of having made Anwar and Saint Laurent with Léa Seydoux in those roles as well, to have that familiarity with Seydoux as an actress and you as a director and this kind of like dynamic between the two of you?
I think more than familiarity, I would use the word trust, you know. I trusted her, and more important, she trusted me. So she really dived into the film, you know, and abandoned herself because she trusted me. She knew I would look at her in a good way, and so she gave a lot in the film, you know. And but I don't think she would have done that much if we didn't have done the two films before.
How important was it for you to kind of place that film then in this meta-textual construct? You know, at the beginning, we're alone with Léa Seydoux with the green screen. There's this kind of like, the film very much acknowledges its own construct in a sense with regards to her as well. Why did you ultimately make that choice?
When I started to write, the first scene I wrote is the prologue, the green screen scene. And I wrote it quite quickly, and I knew that would be in the final film. And because there is a lot in this scene for me, you know, that says the film. There is the fact that, for everyone in the world, you know, they relate green screen with the idea of virtuality, you know. So it says, okay, in the film, not everything will be real, you know, but you say that very, very early in the film, at the beginning. And second is, you have, I don't know, the scene maybe is 3 minutes or something, but you have for 3 minutes like Léa, like lost in this green ocean. And it's another way to say, okay, whatever the story is, my subject, it's her, you know. It's her, Gabrielle, but also her, Léa. And the third thing is, you have this scene cut in two. One is me talking to her, and then we go into fiction, you know. And the idea that she has nothing to act, like no furniture, just herself, and everything is out of scene, you know. It's a way to say, okay, the beast is something that is going to be unseen, you know. And then when you enter 1910, you enter loaded with something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like a pre-briefing almost of exactly. Getting into the film. Could you put some more words on this idea of the film being about Gabrielle, the character of Léa Seydoux, and about Léa Seydoux, the actors in the film? Because I think if you see the film, you understand it. It's somewhere between the lines constantly of the scenes and the way that, you know, she's in the frame and the way that you approach the character and the actress. But it's quite hard to put into words what that actually means or what that actually looks like. So what are some of the decisions that you then have to make to make that distinction or that connection between those two entities, basically?
Well, I think when you make a 2 hours and 25 minutes film with an actress, which is from the first shot to the last, playing three characters, which are at the same time three characters, but only one. At one moment, you have so much of the actress, you know, she's not just acting, there's so much of her. I didn't push that. I mean, it happened. And Léa has a particular way to work, is that she does not work in a way, you know. Like, I think she's read the script, but I'm not even sure, you know. But when she arrives on the set, she don't really know what's going to be shot. So I come to her and I say, okay, today we're going to do this and this and this. Then I explain the scene we are shooting now. And then just before I say action, I come to her and I try to find like three or four words that would ring a bell in her mind, you know, to find the feeling and stuff like that. And she throws herself. So, of course, there is a lot of herself. You know, it's not like she's been thinking of the character for 3 months. It's not like that. George is like that, but not Léa. So there is a lot of herself. It has to be like that.
Speaking of Léa, you know, alone in these rooms all the time, I think a lot of people also want to make this connection between Goma and between The Beast as films about isolation. You know, The Beast very much was a response to the COVID lockdown and some of the fears that you have for the future. Also in the film, it is kind of a letter to your daughter as well. The Beast very much stems from this kind of like emotional isolation that Léa Seydoux's character experiences in 2044, where emotions are basically scrubbed and where people are basically all the time alone in rooms and not really interacting with each other anymore. How do you see the connection between the two, and what fed into maybe that idea of isolation being suddenly so prevalent in your films, whereas before that you had so much group dynamics in them?
Well, it's true there are connections between the two films. I think the main reason is that at the beginning of 2021, I was ready to shoot The Beast, and we had to postpone the film of more than a year because of Léa's schedule. So I had a free year in front of me, and the producer said, okay, let's do something. You want to do like a short movie? I said, no, let's do a feature, but with the budget of a short movie. So of course The Beast was ready. So I was probably more or less consciously trying some stuff, you know. And both films are really about loneliness, very much. But I also tried stuff to go for a ratio to another, to mix different worlds, different types of images. So I think that's why they're so connected. It's because I was preparing The Beast while I was doing Chroma.
And I think both of them very much speak of this kind of this gnawing fear of what's to come. You mentioned it a little bit earlier as well, but I think it would be good to maybe start a bit more with Goma, and if you can put into the word what the letter was that you wanted to cinematically, the gesture that you wanted to give to your daughter and her generation, for, you know, also the listeners of us that haven't had the pleasure to watch the film because it didn't get a Dutch release yet, sadly. So what was kind of like, because it feels like a gesture mostly, that film, what it was that you wanted to convey through that film?
Well, you know, during the lockdown, there was all this, everybody was saying, well, there was the world of yesterday and the world of tomorrow. And so, of course, and in fact, what is a lockdown? It's, you know, it's time that stops. Time stops. You're always in the present in the life, and then the present stops. So what do you do at that moment? You look behind and you look in front of you, you know, but not the present, like the past or the future. And of course, I was watching my daughter, and for me, spending like a couple of months in my house, it's not a problem, you know. But at that age, the age where you should leave the house, go into the world, you know, it's the moment where They told you, you don't move. Okay? So it's very shocking and very disturbing for people of, I don't know, like 18 or... And that makes me think about many, many things about, her going into the world, you know, and how she's going to leave it, find it, transform it. And of course, we live a kind of tough world. When I was a teenager, I grew with the idea that tomorrow will be better than today. And with this generation, since they are born, we tell them that tomorrow will be worse than today, you know? So it's a very, very huge difference, mainly about desires. I grew up with the idea that desires can be possible. And this generation is that nothing can be possible, you know? And it's very strong difference.
I think your films speak to that in such an interesting way. And we've spoken about this before, and then I asked about your films all being this kind of like ghost stories, because they're, you know, about this past, the specter of the past that's lurking somewhere in the present and in the future. But I like, in any case, even if there's this interesting bridge constantly in your films between the past and the present, or the past and the future, and desire is a good word for it, but also this kind of like death is also just the specter that looms over the films, for instance, in The Pornographer and in Saint Laurent and in Zombie Child. But it's, sorry for the abstract question, but there's like, it's hard to kind of like really put it into words, but I feel that your films have this bridging quality between these two weird states that were constantly pinpointed in between. Could you somehow speak to that a little bit, how film can actually address those things, can address kind of like the limitations of our desires now in the real world, that can address that time is stopping, because in film time never stops, of course.
Well, I think freedom and desire, or lack of freedom and lack of desire, is probably like the subject that goes, you know, running into my films. Probably my obsession, you know. I was born in 1968, and you know, I was a kid of all this generation has done so many things for freedom and stuff like that. For good, for bad, we don't know. It's not the question, but it's a fact. So when I was like 15, I always asked myself, okay, now us, what can we do if our parents have done so much, you know? And the world's changed when I turned to 15, you know, it's like the 80s, you know, the world changes a lot. And 80s looked from now, you know, like a big party, fantastic, but it's not, you know, it's the beginning of the end of the world, in a way, the beginning of the end of civilization. And of course, I saw so much progress, and then I saw the backlash of the progress. So these questions are very strong inside me, you know. I'm not asking them to myself, they are just here.
And then I think that feeds into this future, which is the present, but it is 2044 in The Beast. And it is a sci-fi film, and it is a melodrama, and it is a film about ghosts. But I'm wondering, this present future that you show, is it an exaggeration of a fear that you have, or is it a sci-fi construct that helps to propel the film, or is it all of these things, or is it something entirely different?
It's a mix of the two, I guess. You know, as I said earlier, I mean, making a science fiction film is a way to talk about your fear of the present. And one of them is, of course, relationship between technology and humanity. But with this question, you know, I invent something. What's great about science fiction is that allows you to invent concepts, you know, and in order to write a story. So in this film, there are two concepts. One is that humanity has failed and AI took like the power. And the second one is like, you have a character and she has to choose, she has a dilemma, either having like a interesting job or either losing emotion. Either a good job and losing emotions, or keeping emotions like and being useless. So it's a horrible dilemma, but it allows me to write the story.
By the way, one more question about Coma. Has your daughter seen the film? Does she watch your movies?
I don't know. Ines, she's seen The Beast because she was with me. Coma, I don't know. She doesn't live in France. She lives in Canada, and she told me a lot of friends came and see a film. I don't know if she was in theater, but she's too shy. She wouldn't take.
That's sweet. But I heard that like The Beast is a film that a lot of young people in France also are seeing, right? It's like the predominant demographic is like youngsters.
My audience like gets younger and younger. And when I was doing like a little French tour, I was surprised to see that in some theaters, like you had like 80% of people between 17 and 26, I would say.
That's quite incredible. And I think it speaks to this feeling that I have that it has to do maybe with the way that you approach the image, that you approach the medium, that you take maybe their world and the textures of their world seriously or something.
I think it's a mix of many things, maybe the subjects that they enjoy and stuff like that. And also relationship with the form, the structure, you know, not so classical, and relationship with music. I think it's a mix of things.
Well, I hope that in the Netherlands that the same demographic will also come out.
I hope
because
too.
I think it is a film that speaks to them very much. Bertrand, before I let you go, I have to ask two questions. And one is actually about the sweater that you're wearing, because I see that you have a fantastic ghost dog, the Way of a Samurai sweater. Hell yeah, that's awesome. Which is my favorite Jarmusch movie. But I think I read once that Jarmusch kind of kickstarted your interest in filmmaking yourself, right?
Yes. It was Stranger Than Paradise. And I was really, really into music. Like I was a session man and with a lot of job and stuff like that. And then I went to see this film, like I didn't know who he was. And when I came out of the theater, I can see that some movies can be really rock and roll too, you know. This film really talked to me, and it really helped me to switch from music to cinema.
And has that been an aspiration of you, or a thing that has always been a bit in the back of your mind that your films should still be rock and roll?
Well, I don't know what rock and roll means for a film,
yeah.
But I mean, at least, we were talking about talking to a young generation, and that's part of it, I guess.
And then we have one final question, and I think it follows very nicely into that one. At the end of our episode with our guests, we always ask, and it's a very broad one again, so forgive me, what their hopes are for the future, because we have spoken about, let's say, some fears, but we always ask everybody what maybe their hopes are as well. And that can be as broad as you want it to be.
I am very sorry. I'm going to say something very common, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I have some hopes for justice and common sense.
Well, I think those are very great things to finalize this interview with. Bertrand Bonello, thank you so much for being with us here at Celebrating Cinema. The Beast will be out in Dutch theaters on the 9th of May, so I hope that everybody runs, not walks, to go see it in the cinema. Thank you again for your film and for your kind words today.
Thank you, Hugo. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. My pleasure.
You can book tickets to see The Beast via the link in the show notes or at lab111.nl. I hope to see you there, as I can't wait to watch it again on the big screen. This was a Lab 111 production, edited and produced by Elliot Bloom, music from myself, and artwork by Studio FFF.